Alrighty then, the Committee on Energy Utilities and Telecommunications will be in order. Today and next Tuesday, we're going to have a thorough review on the Conservation Improvement Program. Closed in your packet, members, is the 0708 OES Conservation Improvement Program Energy and Carbon Dioxide Savings Report. I hope you've all read it and ready to get going. Now, the reason why we're having this hearing the next 2 days is there has been some concerns raised about the SIP program, and there's been some very good things about the SIP program. So we're just going to really open it up and have a good discussion and hear from everyone about how this program is working, is it worthwhile, what we should do in the future moving forward. So some of the concerns that have been included here or been raised are if it is cost-effective conservation investments, that cost-effective conservation investments are not available in sufficient quantity or are they dwindling? And I think that's a very good question. I think that's what the number one question we should look at is, can we sustain this program? Number two, that more information is needed on the benefits of SIP to ratepayers. Number three, that in a recessionary period with slow or no energy use growth, energy savings goals are difficult to achieve. So these are just some of the questions that we need to address today that we've heard. Number four, that the investments are not consistently directed at the most cost-effective conservation measures. Another good question. And that the smaller co-ops and munis should have different obligations. So let's think about that when we come up to testify and we ask our questions. And then the last one, that the potential of SIP in the job creation arena has not been fully explored. So those are just some of our questions that we came up with in the front table here. I'm sure you guys will have a lot more. But I know there's going to be some good questions from the godfather of energy over there, Senator Metzen.
Thank you.
So that's your new name, you know, the godfather of energy.
Yeah.
And we're kind of debating whether to do this on Tuesday. I think it's a great idea. I don't know quite how it's going to work, but after we have the testimony today, we'll have the co-ops and the munis and then the Department of Commerce, and they'll have like an open dialogue with each other up there. It's kind of a face-off. I don't know what else to call it. But it could be. And it might be something that we'll bat around, see if we can make that work, see if anybody's open to it. But, they can go back and forth. We can ask questions, and we'll see what happens. So with that, we'll start with the Department of Commerce with the SIP and the SIP Program Administrator. So if Jeffrey Haas, the State Program Administrator Director, would come up, and Bill Grant, the Director of Office Energy Security. Welcome, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And please state your name for the record, and Please have fun with the program. Tell us what's going on and your view.
We will do that. Thank you again, Madam Chair. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce Office of Energy Security, and I have with me Jeffrey Haas, who is manager of our Conservation Improvement Program area. I'm going to kick this off with a few slides kind of at the higher level, and Jeff is going to dig into some of the details a little bit more for you. We were made aware of some of the questions that you asked on behalf of the committee, and we hope that our presentation addresses those questions. And to the extent that it doesn't, please, we're of course open to your questions throughout and at the end of our testimony. So just to kick this off, again, we are from the Office of Energy Security within the Minnesota Department of Commerce. We are the ones who have SIP review and approval authority under statute. And so unlike many issues that your committee deals with where we're providing advice and recommendation to the Public Utilities Commission, this is one case where the buck really does stop here with us on this. Of course, cost recovery of SIP still remains an issue at the commission, but we're the ones who are reviewing utility-sponsored program filings and making recommendations and decisions on those. We've been providing energy information for over 30 years in a variety of areas, energy conservation, efficiency, and renewables, through technology, analysis, grants, programs, public outreach, We participate in a variety of outreach activities to the general public. For example, we're every year at the state fair with a booth to answer questions from citizens around the state about their energy use and how they can become more efficient, save money, what have you. Let me turn to what Jeff and I hope to cover this afternoon. We want to give you a brief history of SIP. It's been around now, I think, in our fourth decade. So we have a long and rich history to describe here. We want to talk about our orientation toward energy efficiency as a resource for utilities and for consumers, both. We want to talk about the costs of the program, the benefits that derive from those costs, and some of the challenges and opportunities that were created by the Next Generation Energy Act of a few years ago, which was, of course, the most significant change to the program in the last few years. Starting with a little bit of history, you can see that this dates all the way back to 1980, when the Godfather was in short pants, probably. And
I should have stayed home, I think.
And it was at that point that the Public Utilities Commission was directed to initiate a pilot program to demonstrate the feasibility of energy efficiency investments. And we had long and very painful conversations about things like how many feet of weather stripping ought to go into an audit kit when utilities offered energy audits for their customers. We managed to move beyond that in 83 to a requirement that utilities with revenues in excess of $15 million were required to operate at least one conservation program. And that's where we started with this concept that utilities needed to make a significant investment. Of course, there was a lot of debate around the term significance, and I think we've come a long ways toward defining what that in fact means. In 89, all utilities were required to operate programs, and the oversight at that point was transferred from the PUC to what is now the Office of Energy Security. In 1991, a specific level of spending was required, a percent and a half of gross operating revenues by electric utilities, a half a percent by gas utilities. And at that point, municipal and cooperative utilities were included in the program for the first time. In 1994, we had the painful Prairie Island year, and that among other things, created a larger obligation on Xcel, what was then NSP, now Xcel Energy, to spend 2% of their revenues, their gross operating revenues, on conservation programs. And, of course, then in 2007, the Next Generation Energy Act, which we'll be getting into here in a moment. So what are the challenges and opportunities kind of at the big picture level? Energy efficiency has always been a challenging resource to acquire because it requires an upfront investment of capital that competes with other priorities that consumers have. We often talk about a homeowner trying to make the decision between replacing that old carpeting and putting insulation in the attic. Even though if you pencil it out in terms of the net value to the consumer of those two investments, assuming they were roughly equal investments, the energy savings that would derive from the attic insulation would pay for itself many times before the homeowner sold the home, and the carpet would probably have to be replaced again in 10 years. It's still that intrinsic value of, gee, I'd really like to have new carpeting. And those investments often compete with each other for consumers' attention. There's a lot of fragmentation of opportunities. And for example, renters in buildings that are master metered don't have the same incentive to invest in conservation because they're not really the ones that they're paying for the bill indirectly, but they're not able to affect the amount of usage in the same way, or the bills that the landlord is paying in the same way as a homeowner can. There's often low awareness and attention to efficiency opportunities, and we find this time and again, and as often as and as long as we've been talking about energy conservation, we're often surprised at the department about the lack of knowledge in the general public about what efficiency opportunities exist. And then there are measurement issues. The question, what would have happened if you hadn't made the investment in efficiency, is always one that we're trying to answer, because it's integral to really understanding what the magnitude of the opportunity is. And measuring efficiency is not the same as measuring how many kilowatts or kilowatt hours of electricity was produced at a power plant. It's inherently more difficult to measure. So those are some of the challenges. But on the opportunities side, we're seeing new technologies entering the market all the time, and new opportunities for consumers to save energy. We are seeing over time improved customer awareness, and I think that that's certainly more the case as energy prices have gone up as a percentage of people's bills. And certainly this is true for larger customers, larger commercial and industrial customers. As energy prices have gone up, the attention that they've been willing to pay to the efficiency opportunity has definitely grown over time. When we talk about the value of efficiency, again, kind of at the 10,000-foot level, it's important to remember how inefficient the conversion of fuel to useful energy is, even before we get to what the end use opportunities are. 63% of the total input into our energy system is lost through the difficulty in converting, for example, fossil fuels into useful electricity, or natural gas into heat energy. Some fuel sources are more efficient than others, certainly, but on the grand scale, we're losing two-thirds of the energy that we're importing into the state to provide service to consumers, the fuel as the input, before it ever gets to the end consumer. And so we're talking then after that about what's left and trying to be as efficient as possible in that. At the department, we work with parties across the board, but one of the things that we think that this particular program does is put the utility companies that have SIP obligations in much closer contact with their customers. And we hear this all the time, that energy consumers rely on, respect the advice that they get from their utilities, count on them to be the ones to tell them not only what their energy use options are, but also what their conservation opportunities are. So we're working closely with utilities to help them educate their consumers, engage them, in other words, become the energy expert that they can rely on, and we provide technical assistance in that area. And then finally, the enticement is the actual nub of the conservation programs that most utilities run, the rebate, the other forms of incentives that utilities encourage their consumers with to become more efficient. The Next Generation Energy Act, as I mentioned before, really was the thing that most fundamentally transformed the SIP program since the beginning of the program. We went from a spending goal, in other words, tracking utility performance by how much money they were spending for energy conservation, to a savings goal, which I think the legislature at the time felt was really, of course, the objective we were all shooting for anyway. This wasn't the how to spend a few million dollars program. This was how do we make investments on behalf of consumers to actually save energy. And so establishing the goal as an energy savings goal really makes more sense in terms of how to organize the program. But of course, tracking how much is spent is much more readily quantifiable than tracking how much was saved. So for that reason, implementing a goal approach, a savings goal approach, is inherently more difficult than tracking a spending program. And it relies not only then on understanding the issue from the utility's perspective, but also from the consumer's perspective. We do think, though, as I say, that savings is the proper emphasis. Otherwise, really, only it becomes a bean counting exercise to make sure that the right amount of money was spent. Of course, we have a wide array of utilities that provide services to Minnesotans. We have, on the electric side, four large investor-owned utilities that provide 66% of sales across the state, 44 distribution cooperatives that provide another 20% of those sales. Those local distribution co-ops are served by six generation and transmission cooperatives around the state. And we have 126 municipal utilities that account for 14% of the sales, and many of them are aggregated under a joint action supplier in the same way that the generating and transmission cooperatives aggregate load for the co-ops that they serve. So clearly, that means that we've got a number of different delivery agents for the SIP program. They span the spectrum from very large corporate entities to very small city agencies and everything in between. This gives you some idea of dollars that are spent annually by both electric and natural gas consumers in the state, roughly $5 billion a year for electricity cumulatively across all consumers, and nearly $4 billion a year for natural gas. And of course, since only a very small fraction of the fuel source for electrical energy is from sources here in Minnesota, all of those dollars, or nearly all of those dollars, are leaving the state to purchase fuel and other related equipment for the generation of electricity and the supply of natural gas. And non-energy expenditures due to investments in energy efficiency are very hard to quantify. We've asked the question about, you know, what's left to do. We've been running this program in various forms since 1980, and I think it would be reasonable to assume that not only all of the low-hanging fruit has been plucked, but the whole tree has been plucked. And what we're finding is that that's not the case, that utilities continue to identify cost-effective programs and efficiency opportunities are still very available. A big part of that is because new technologies continue to enter the marketplace that drive efficiency opportunities in a variety of energy-using sectors. And as I mentioned before, energy costs have risen, making more energy efficiency opportunities cost-effective for consumers.
Mr. Grant?
Yes.
Do you have an example of what you're just saying, that some of the new technologies or something that's coming online?
Madam Chair, I do. LED lighting, for example, is one of the newest opportunities on the electricity side that we think is going to transform lighting systems across the board. We went from, of course, highly inefficient incandescent lighting, which is still in fairly wide use, terribly inefficient. All you need to know to understand that is if you touch an incandescent light bulb, you can't hold on to it for very long without giving yourself a third-degree burn, as opposed to an LED light, which you can, you know, put on your Christmas tree and leave burning for as long as you want because there simply is very little heat. And that means that those lighting systems are converting the electrical energy much more efficiently. And as those as that technology really enters the marketplace, we expect big future gains in efficiency and in lighting efficiency for customers of all kinds.
The cost will go down.
And the costs are going down all the time as those technologies enter the marketplace, go through the normal pattern of becoming mass produced, and costs fall dramatically as that transformation takes place. Another big area that we really have only begun to look at significantly is we've done a lot of work on the customer side of the meter. In other words, how are energy consumers using energy in their buildings, in their homes, and what have you? What we haven't done as good a job in looking at is what can the energy suppliers do on their side of the meter to become more efficient in the way they generate power, in the way they deliver that power to consumers, the way they transmit that power over power lines. Again, lots of new technologies entering the marketplace that have dramatically improved efficiency on the supply side of the equation that very, with a lot of forethought, the crafters of the Next Generation Energy Act included in what was allowed in at least a portion of meeting the 1.5% goal. So that's a new opportunity that really has not been fully explored. And we think that, you know, new entrants to the field on the technology side will be critical to identifying new opportunities as we go forward. You'd asked also, Madam Chair, about, you know, what is the real value to Minnesotans, to consumers of energy? We're all consumers of energy at one level or another. Participating customers have really realized tremendous value economically to them as a result of this program. On an annual basis, we estimate that at roughly $40 million a year. And even though we only count savings on the utilities side in the first year, need to remember that once we've made those investments, they continue to provide savings for the life of those investments, usually 15 or 20 years. So this is actually a very conservative estimate of what the lifetime impact of investments in energy efficiency have been. And we estimate that net benefits accruing to investor-owned utility customers on the electric side are more than $330 million, and that's largely because in addition to the savings that customers themselves are realizing, they're also realizing the benefit, both participants and those who don't participate in the energy conservation programs, of avoided expenses for new power plants, new transmission lines, all of the equipment that is needed to provide service to consumers, all of which is many times more expensive than saving that same kilowatt hour or therm of gas.
Mr. Grant, was that $330 million annually? Or is that total from the inception?
That's an annual number. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
So, as I say, that really has, these programs really have reduced the need for new higher cost facilities, particularly, of course, on the electric side, where the electric utility business is just a much more capital intensive business to provide service to consumers. So naturally, there are more capital costs to avoid when we save energy on the electric side. So looking just at the first year of energy savings from programs that were running here, there were $287 million in total spending for 2008 and 2009 across all utility types. And of that, you know, with that money, we've saved over a billion kilowatt hours of electricity. That's enough to power 120,000 homes. We've saved 3.5 billion cubic feet of natural gas, enough to heat 34,000 homes. And if you accumulate that over a little bit longer period, you can see the savings that we've achieved and the amount. And this is just to give you some context for these numbers. We're really talking about significant amounts of energy being saved as a result of these programs. Uh, This really is just thinking about it in a little bit differently and putting it again in context that the savings that we're achieving are about 7% of annual sales on the electric side and almost 5% of annual sales on the gas side. Again, with a little bit longer period of time, we've got nearly $500 million spent on behalf of energy consumers, both on the electric and the gas side. I wanted to close with a couple of slides, just again, before I turn it over to Jeff, bigger picture. I mentioned before that we consider energy conservation, known in the business as DSM or demand side management, as really a resource that we look at as we evaluate utility plans beyond just what their requirements are to meet their SIP obligations. With electric utilities in particular, we do it every 2 years, a resource plan with those utilities that looks at, based on the load forecast that they give us, in other words, how much kilowatt hours they're going to have to provide consumers to meet their energy needs, how best to combine both supply side and demand side resources to meet those objectives. And we look at just about everything you can imagine as alternatives toward meeting that future need. If we can save energy as part of that plan, we can avoid some of the later steps that this graph indicates. If we can't, we've got to build new facilities. That requires a certificate of need at the Public Utilities Commission. We've got to go through an energy facility siting process to permit the power plants and the power lines that are associated with that. And then we've got to travel to a rate case in order for the utilities to recover the expenses associated with those costs. So if we can maximize the efficiency opportunity at the front end, we can avoid a lot of regulatory process at the back end that otherwise is very costly, time-consuming, and just adds to the cost of providing electric service if we can't save the energy instead. And one more slide, Madam Chair, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Haas, unless there are questions of me at this point. Wanted to give you some idea of where we would have been had we not invested in SIP all of these years. The lower part of the line gives you the actual growth in kilowatt hour sales that we've seen over the period from 2005 to projected out to 2025. And the line above is, and the delta between the difference between those two are the amount that we've actually been able to drive down energy use. In other words, this top line would have been our energy use had it not been for the Conservation Improvement Program. And as you can see, we would have had a much bigger gap to fill with supply-side resources, which, again, would have cost consumers substantially more than the efficiency programs that we have been operating.
Thank you. Mr. Grant. I can't see read those the dates on the bottom, but do you have a chart that would show the projection of the impact of SIP going forward with our economic situation that we're in right now, and what do you foresee that
Madam
line
Chair,
to be?
Yeah. Madam Chair, thank you. Yeah, this graph goes from 2005 out to 2025, and we've tried to incorporate in that what we think is a reasonable estimate of load growth over that time, considering economic conditions as they are now, and a kind of a medium growth projection based on where we are now, and assuming we at least recover to some degree or not in the economy.
Okay, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question: if you go back, the more recent slides talked about how much was spent overall expenditures.
Yes.
And slides before that talked about how much was saved for ratepayers, and I wondered if you could give us a number that would compare some apples and apples there. You said total utility expenditure since 2006, $494 million. Do you have that savings number for that same time period for all utility? Or can you give us a comparison of savings versus spending overall?
Certainly, Madam Chair and Senator Anderson. I mean, the number there that to keep in mind is roughly $40 million a year is the net savings to consumers. In other words, we're spending in the neighborhood of $250 million a year, and we have savings approaching $300 million a year.
Perfect. Thank you.
And Senator Jungberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grant, in looking at the chart you had on the SIP, we don't have your PowerPoint, but I guess I'd love to look at those years and actually get some more statistical data on that, because I guess I find it just at first blush harder to believe, knowing that we've had a major economic recession. And, you know, you think about things like construction, 50% of the people in construction sitting without working. And, I mean, that would be a major energy eater that's not going on today. And so it's hard to imagine that these are really the savings without seeing all the inputs into that kind of a graphing system. So is that something that we can get to know how you came up with these kind of energy saving impacts?
Madam Chair and Senator Jungbauer, of course, would be happy to provide that. You know, these numbers, obviously we're making a projection on future load growth as we do this, and that's inherently risky. Whatever projection we make is going to be wrong, but these numbers in the early years certainly do reflect the fact that load growth has slowed substantially on the electric side. We were growing at, you know, somewhere between 2 and 3% a year on the electric side. We're at least half that or around 1% a year now. So these numbers reflect that, but it also attempts to reflect that we're hopefully not going to be in that situation forever.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Grant. And the reason I'm so curious about it is I've done a lot of in-depth looks at for example, the cap and trade in the European communities. And, you know, which at first looked as though the cap and trade was working, but it was in a heck of an economic recession. And as soon as the recession started moving the other direction, there showed no improvement in terms of a cap and trade program. So it really depends on, you know, looking at hardcore numbers. I'm kind of assuming, you know, that hopefully we made better numbers projections here than the European communities might have in things. But I'm a numbers guy. I just know that numbers can be manipulated on both sides, and would love to see what kind of inputs went in there so we can really gauge the accuracy of things that we look at.
And Madam Chair and Senator Jungbauer, happy to provide our analysis to you.
Thanks.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Senator Jungbauer's points is an excellent one. I think the statute actually requires that you control for economy and, you know, and kind of variables that are out there. This is a great chart, because the misperception that we often run into when we're talking about SIP is that we need to reduce the amount of energy being generated by 1.5% per year, period. I've had to kind of work that through with colleagues who think we actually have to reduce the amount of it. No, obviously the use of energy is going to be going up as our economy grows and as our population goes up. What would be interesting, Mr. Grant, is Deputy Commissioner Grant, if we could see the per capita use of energy. I know that we talked about that a lot when we were first discussing the Next Generation Energy Act, and citing the example of California, you know, kind of the consumer culture center of the universe, where they buy every trinket and toy you can imagine that sucks up a lot of energy, but they've managed to keep the per capita use of energy. Obviously, overall energy use has gone up, their population has gone up, et cetera, but their per capita use has remained flat because they've been really aggressive in their conservation policies.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I'm just to Senator Jungbauer's comment. It looks like you plugged in one number up until 2009 as far as the growth rate, and then another number for the rest of the graph, and, you know, because you've got that straight line. And then I'm just wondering, you know, with the savings there, what causes that to dip like it's going to have more savings? I mean, what is it, just the compound effect of this 1.5? Is that what we're looking at? I mean, what's the figure that you're using there to compound that?
Sure, and Senator Howell, I'll let Mr. Haas take that one.
Mr. Haas, could you please state your name for the record, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Haas.
Welcome.
I'm a conservation program supervisor for the department's oversight activities for this program. And Madam Chair, Senator Howe, the answer is exactly that the dip at 2009 represents the impact of the change of the 1.5% conservation goal. Prior to that date, we were kind of going along at a clip of about 0.7%, 0.7 to 0.8% annually. And the goal, you know, being phased in over that period of time from 2007 to 2010, and now all utilities are working under the assumption that they're going to at least try to achieve that level of savings. Again, this graph is an attempt to project outward into the future what the savings would be relative to that which would have been achieved had we not had SIP at all, not necessarily where we're going from where SIP had been to what the new law and the new requirements are for utilities.
Manager, follow up. So it looks like in about 2021 we maximize our savings, and then it's constant. Then is that where we reach our maximum potential there?
Well, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Howe, that reflects some changes in codes and appliance efficiency that are projected to kick in full effect at that point in time. And I'll talk a little bit about how codes and standards and appliance efficiency standards really have an impact on what utility savings are and what we claim in terms of that.
Senator Chungba?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Grant, and to kind of Senator Dibble's point, as I was looking through, and you're thinking about in dealing with some of the utilities we were talking about with the SIP and it kind of reaching that maximum or flat line of consumer use of electricity or other energy sources. And Mr. Grant, you had mentioned earlier in one of your slides that, you know, 63% of the efficiency kind of is lost in the front end in bringing the energy to some form we can use. So, members, I was thinking out loud as we're talking about these kind of issues, and as some of the utilities have talked about, you know, flatlining in their specific areas or thinking that they can only educate consumers so far to get them to change, should we, Mr. Grant, do you think, be at least gearing some of our attention in the SIP program towards those emerging technologies that would really become much more efficient on the front end?
Mr. Grant.
Madam Chair and Senator Youngbauer, as I mentioned, we think that the 2007 legislation actually pointed us in that direction by encouraging utilities and the department to look at supply-side savings opportunities at the same time that we were looking at savings opportunities on the customer side of the meter. I also, I think, germane to your question is the fact that in addition to new technologies that are coming online all the time, we have new approaches to dealing with consumer behavior are coming on stream at the same time. I don't know if you're getting it at your house from your energy supplier. I am at mine. I'm getting a statement every couple of months comparing my energy usage to that of my neighbors, my average neighbors. And what we're finding with programs like that have been implemented now in many places across the country is that's a very powerful motivator for people, whether they're doing better than the average consumer neighbor, or whether they're doing whether they're doing worse than their neighbors. In both cases, it seems to drive more efficient behavior.
Senator
Jungba. Yeah, Madam Chair, on that one, I'd love to explain that one, since Conexus Energy does, in fact, do that in my area, and it kind of tends to antagonize people in my area. And even myself, for example, since we're not in I don't want to call it cookie cutter houses, but in housing development, since all my children come home to get their cars repaired in my shop out back, and you know, whether it's my daughter rear-ending people and I have to rebuild the front end of the car and, you know, fire up the welder and doing the exhaust systems, it's not a fair comparison in our area against the neighbor that doesn't do any of those sorts of things. So it tends to be pretty antagonistic in my specific area. But I think those are useful tools
if
comparing to similar usages.
This is a good one.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Madam Chair, Senator Metz and I were just talking. Maybe you've got a grow house over there. I'm not sure.
Senator Junkbauer.
And Madam Chair and Senator House, Senator Metz, and
off the roof.
Sometimes with all the issues I have to try to take care of with my family, I think about these potential revenue-generating sources. Of course, only in products that are currently legal.
Mr. House, if you could continue, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, I'll follow that up.
That's good. That was good.
Senator Dibble touched on this just recently, and it has to do with how we calculate the goal, the 1.5% energy savings goal. The notion that it is not a absolute reduction requirement. The way in which we go about working with utilities to develop their savings goal is to really look at their previous 3 years' average sales over that period of time and establish an energy savings goal based on that three-year average. We then, because utilities are on a three-year planning cycle, we'll use that three-year average for the 1.5% savings goal as a constant for the next 3 years. So what we're doing is really establishing kind of a baseline for energy savings and then carrying that forward and saying this is your goal in years, you know, whether it's 2011 through 2013, 2012 through 2014, that goal remains constant. Following the completion of a triennial period, the next plan year will take into account some of those energy savings, or it might take into account energy growth, and reset that 1.5% annual savings goal based on the sales that a utility's or the variation in a utility sales over that period of time. So it's a way to really allow for either growth in a utility sales or a decline in utility sales to be readjusted over time. And we hope that balances out. But you're absolutely correct that, you know, electricity sales continue to grow, and what we're really looking to do is mitigate that growth by that 1.5% number. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, how that 1.5% figure in the energy savings that a utility can achieve is really variable from 1 year to the next, and it has a lot to do with the opportunities that are in place for customers and what really large customers are able to implement in any given year. That can really drive a utility's ability to meet this goal or even exceed it in some years. Commissioner Grant mentioned, 0.5% of the overall savings goal can come from different areas of supply, energy savings on the supply side if you're looking at new transformers, generation savings that can take place within a plant, energy-efficient motors, pumps, fans, and auxiliary equipment within plants have a tremendous amount of potential, partly because of the long runtime hours that these end-use pieces of equipment have. If you're operating in a baseload plant and you have a large motor that's running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, changing the efficiency of that piece of equipment, even 1%, is going to have a tremendous impact on the overall consumption of that piece of equipment. And so to begin looking at these supply savings, counting toward that 0.5% above 1%, and I'll talk a little bit more about what we're doing in that regard here. But first, I want to just go over some of the new utility conservation improvement program plans that we have.
Right now, all of our utilities are operating under a plan or have direction to meet the minimum 1%, and in some cases meeting that 1.5% savings goal. And really, when we started working with utilities back in 07, there was a bit of, I'll say, distress among many of them as far as how are we going to do this? Not only how are we going to do this now, or how are we going to do this on a long-term basis? And when it came down to it, it was a matter of trying to increase participation in the existing programs, trying to find new opportunities for energy savings, and that's where some of the behavioral program activities come into play. And it also required that we look a little harder at how we validate savings and measure the savings and make sure that we're getting exactly what our assumptions are suggesting that we should be getting from these efficiency improvements. But generally speaking, the new plans came in and they were characterized by, you know, higher incentives to try to drive increased participation with customers, increased levels of advertising, promotion, and education. Basically, how do you build awareness for these programs? They've been around a long time, and you still end up having conversations with people that, you know, don't know about it. And I know there's certainly a lot of behaviors related to SIP, such as either not knowing, you know, who your electric utility is, which happens a fair amount, not knowing what your bill is because you've got it in auto pay and you're not paying attention to it, and the notion of, you know, bill inserts being one of the key ways in which utilities have advertised their programs, many people just shake the bill inserts out into, you know, the recycling bin and then, you know, move on. And so developing new ways of outreach and building awareness is, you know, a critical component of achieving these greater levels of participation. In addition, looking at more direct customer interactions, especially on the commercial and industrial side, developing new outreach programs and technology assistance programs for large commercial industrial customers to really try to provide a good value to them and identify very large energy savings potential.
Madam Chair?
On that issue, how are you reaching out, Madam Chair, Mr. Haas, to the commercial and industrial customers out there? Because there's a number of good programs available, and how do you let those people that create the jobs and are in this area know that these programs exist?
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, there's a number of ways. Many utilities, for at least the largest customers, have direct account representation for large customers. And so there's really a relationship that goes on between the utility's account executive that handles that account and the commercial industrial organization. In addition to that, there are new ways. Franklin Energy is working with Minnesota Energy Resources Corporation on what they've termed a turnkey program to go out and really do a lot of outreach and offer both assistance to identifying new savings opportunities and then helping to carry them through the stages of implementation all the way to, you know, measurement and verification of those activities.
That's very good. Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Haas?
There's a lot of numbers, and I'm just going to run through these next slides because it illustrates some of the changes in the magnitude of investments and energy savings that the utilities are being that really they're planning for and achieving. And you notice the bars here represent the expenses of the program, and the line at the top is really where the savings trajectories are for these programs. You'll notice some dips variations, and some of those variations in the savings side do reflect large program activities or large projects being implemented by large industrial or commercial customers. Some of the, at least on the electric side, there's not as an abrupt change as you see on the gas side. And the reason for that has to do with the fact that prior to 2007, gas utilities were held to a spending goal of 0.5%, which was three times less as a percentage of their total gross operating revenues than what electric utilities were being held to. And so we kind of use a rule of thumb that says, well, in order to achieve a 3% or I'm sorry, in order to achieve, you know, a 1% energy savings, you're going to be looking at about double that as a percentage of your overall gross operating revenues. So if you're looking at achieving 1% of energy savings, you're looking at 2% of an investment of your overall gross operating revenues. And that seems to hold true for both gas and electric utilities. And so gas utilities really saw a marked increase in the amount of money that they were going to be required to spend in order to reach this 1.5% savings level. again, you here on Xcel Gas, you see some kind of an ebb and flow to the savings, and that really is true for all utilities, where you know the savings opportunities and the responsiveness of customers, you know, is going to have some degree of variability from one year to the next. Municipal and cooperative utilities, and this kind of lumps them all together. I apologize, I wasn't able to break this out a little more. But they've had a tremendous increase in the amount of savings they're realizing. They're, of course, increasing the level investment in these programs as well. But it's showing a lot of good successes in the level of energy savings that are being realized. As far as our role and the role of the Office of Energy Security is concerned, we're really looking at all of these utilities, the 130 or so municipal utilities, 44 distribution utilities, distribution cooperatives, and the investor-owned natural gas and electric utilities, and trying to provide them with guidance as well as trying to streamline some of the reporting requirements that come back up to the office. It's a tremendous challenge when you look at the landscape of all of the utilities to understand exactly what their customer characteristics are, what their opportunities are for program development and program implementation, and and also what their economy is doing. There are certainly utilities that have had a greater impact as a result of the economic recession than others. And there's also variations in the customer makeup between the percentage of residential customers and the percentage of commercial industrial customers. The higher the percentage of commercial industrial customers that one has, the larger the opportunity for some of these big annual game changers from an overall savings standpoint are concerned. But we, as a department, we work on the energy savings assumptions and methodologies that underlie how these savings result, require utilities to conduct measurement and verification activities in certain instances, and also conduct program evaluations as necessary and pursue research and development activities to find new opportunities as well. When we talk about energy savings and where they come from, I tend to think of it as there's three areas of savings that we can see, and those are savings on the capital side, there are savings on the operations and maintenance side, and there's savings on the behavior side. Each one of these have different assumptions that underlie the type of program that would address this type of energy savings activity. And by and large, the history of SIP has lend itself to the capital improvements, capital equipment improvements. part of the reason for that has to do with the relative ease in which a capital improvement project can be implemented as compared to, some of the behavioral or operations and maintenance activities. With a typical energy savings measure, and I'll use lighting or motors as an example, you have really two situations. One is the base case situation, which would represent that what the customer would otherwise do had it not been for the involvement of the utility and the incentives that that are provided by the utility to cause that customer to go with a more efficient option. And it's really the assumptions that underlie how long those equipment upgrades are going to operate in a given year that help us determine what the energy savings are. So really you have a KW rating. In the case of lighting, you have a KW on your base case, a KW on your efficient case. If you put them in a building like this, you can have a pretty good estimation of the number of hours that that these lights are going to be on. And then you are able to arrive at an energy savings value for that. That represents the first year savings, which is what forms the basis for the 1.5% energy conservation goal. But like Commissioner Grant said, these programs have a project lifetime that often lasts 10 to 15 years. And so over that life, these savings are going to accrue and really become embedded within within what would be considered the infrastructure of the utility and provide ongoing savings for that period of time. Within the types of savings that are formed by capital improvements, we have two categories of savings or two categories of projects. That which would be called prescriptive, where it's, I would call them the high volume projects, lighting measures, motors, some furnace measures, boiler measures. There is really an administrative difficulty in going into every house that you would rebate a light bulb or a lighting system retrofit and measuring the existing operating hours and the existing consumption against the post-consumption. And so what we do in this case is look at assumptions. What are some standard assumptions that we can use for different end-use buildings? Schools have a certain number of operating hours. Hospitals have a certain number of operating hours. With that information, we can go and make a pretty good estimation of what the total savings are going to be from an energy efficiency improvement. And within the spectrum of projects that would go on, you have variability because of changes in operation, changes in behavior. We're really looking at, with the assumptions that we establish, really looking at trying to hit that midpoint of that bell curve so that we're getting the most representative savings in any given situation. The second type of program are what we call custom programs, and these would be projects where there is not a nice box to fit into. Process improvements, productivity improvements that occur at a particular customer. And those type of programs and measures really are the bulk of a lot of the savings that come from, that accrue to utilities. Custom programs, when you're talking about productivity increases, we can look at energy intensity, the energy per widget of production, and develop a savings methodology based on improving that production efficiency. That may have an impact of increasing the total amount of production, and so we normalize that to whatever the unit, whatever the total amount of production was before the project went in.
Mr. Haas, but,
yes.
I'm sorry. We have two more people that need to testify. You can hit the highlights, would be great.
Apologize.
Thank you. That's all right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just run through the rest of this. Some of the top commercial industrial efficiency projects. Lighting is the biggest one on the electric side. Boiler efficiency. I would say that some of the biggest, longest impact projects have to do with the energy design assistance that goes into new buildings, new construction. It's really that notion that if we can build it into the building right away on the front end, that savings and that efficiency is going to be there, you know, for the lifetime of that building. And it's much easier to implement at that point than it is to do retroactively. Oh,
you are done.
I hit the wrong button, Madam Chair.
Oh, Jeff.
But let me just run through this in reverse.
We can skip
I will just kind of talk about, you know, where we're going now in moving into the future. What are some of the opportunities for meeting the 1.5% energy conservation goal? There are new technologies that are coming along. Bill mentioned LEDs, and there are a host of other, you know, programmatic elements that I think we hope to see more involvement from other sectors. We have a lot of involvement from contractors, electrical contractors, HVAC and contractors. How do we tap the home remodeling market so we can help to build the efficiency programs into what a home remodeler is going to be doing in a home and perhaps provide a lower incremental cost improvement? Are there any opportunities for cross-fuel conservation, thinking in terms of combined heat and power, CHP, cogeneration? And then where and how can infrastructure improvements be made? And then the challenge of codes and standards. As codes improve and increase, the baseline condition changes, and utilities are able to grab much lower levels of savings. And that has an impact on the overall ability to meet 1.5% savings. However, we believe there's a role that utilities can potentially play in helping to implement codes. We know and will be doing an evaluation of code compliance throughout the state using some stimulus dollars here in the near future, and we are hoping to get an idea of what the level of compliance is with codes throughout the state. Getting to 30% reductions in buildings oftentimes requires bundling of measures, not doing just lighting, but doing some additional program activities. And how do we look at financing efficiency improvements? Obviously, jobs has been on a focal point this year and for several years now. How do we do a better job of tracking job impacts related to SIP? And there are many ways in which jobs are generated through this program. And they provide work for energy consultants, design work, facility trade workers, outside contractors. Minnesota Power has given me some numbers that they have pulled together, looking at how many projects they do in a given year, how many companies that's touching. And we're seeing a lot of energy team creation going on, not in many different types of end-use industries, hospitals, industrial organizations. But we're really leveraging a lot of spending through the rebate dollars that are being provided. There's for $1.3 million in Minnesota's Powers rebate, they're estimating about $40 million in total expenditures on the part of the customers that are participating. Interstate Power and Light is doing some of the same things. They're estimating about $7.6 million on $535,000 in overall rebates. I'm just going to skip to the end of this and turn it over to Commissioner Grant.
Thank you, Mr. House. Mr. Grant.
Real quickly, Madam Chair, just to wrap up and to emphasize some of the points we've made, energy efficiency is something that we regard as a system-wide resource that provides a lot of long-term benefits, both participating customers, people who actually take advantage of rebates and so forth, and the non-participating customers, those that benefit only because they've their utility has avoided investments in new supply. And often we're finding, in fact, in almost all cases, efficiency investments are the lowest cost resource that a utility can acquire. And we cannot, by virtue of the law, order companies to invest in programs that aren't cost effective to consumers and to the state as a whole. Energy efficiency investments, as Jeff was mentioning, generate positive job growth throughout the supply chain. We hope to do a better job in the future of estimating those impacts. We continue, we think, to have a very positive dialogue with the utilities that operate SIP programs throughout the state to identify and work through problems that they've brought to our attention. And I know that they've brought some issues to your committee, Madam Chair, and we intend to work very carefully and closely with them to work through those issues. And I think, finally, it's important to remember that Minnesota really is a national leader in its pursuit of energy efficiency, and we think we're poised to continue that leadership. And if you look at the map, at least according to one analysis, we're kind of the eighth leading state in the country on energy efficiency program design. And
doing some good work in the state, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Grant and Mr. Haas. And Senator Dibble?
Madam Chair, I was wondering if I don't want to delay. I have a number of questions. Will there be an opportunity maybe next Tuesday to bring Mr. Grant and Mr. Haas back?
Oh, absolutely.
Some
and
questions.
Okay. With that. They mentioned the positive relationship they have with the utilities. So how about a face-off?
There we go.
Yeah.
Go right in fact.
It might be kind of fun, but I would like to get the other testifiers
if you wouldn't mind. I'll suspend.
Yeah. Senator Metzen?
Madam Chair, just a quick question. I should know this probably. What are the energy conservation incentives for government buildings? With so many of them around the state, what are we doing in that area? And maybe I should know that, but I don't.
Director Grant?
Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, we actually have a very active program for state-owned buildings. It's the Public Building Energy Efficiency Program, PBEEP, as we call it around the office. We've made significant investments. We have nearly, I think, 80% of state-owned buildings here in the St. Paul area under programs now to drive down the cost of energy in those buildings.
Why don't we expand that somehow? I mean, you've got all these county buildings, all the municipal buildings. Can we go the next step and make sure that they are moving in this direction? I don't know how many square feet are out there for city halls and fire halls and what have you, but it's got to be a tremendous amount of help somehow we could give those
Mr. Grant.
Jurisdictions.
Madam Chair and Senator Metzen, we have actually been looking at just that opportunity for buildings, local government buildings throughout the state. There actually are a number of efforts already underway, and we hope to expand those.
But thank you very much.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, Deputy Commissioner, we're not just looking at that. We have a program.
Yes.
It's the mirror program to the PB program that we do for state buildings. That we make available to local buildings.
To locals,
yeah. So we have a fairly active service model that's available to locals, cities, counties, park authorities, and others.
Good.
Can access that.
Madam Chair, I've been off the committee for 8 years, so I might have missed a step or two of there, but I think that's good information for everybody at the table, though, to make sure that we...
An initiative we passed...
stimulus.
Last year?
Stimulus.
Last year, yeah.
We missed you, Senator Metzen.
Well,
we missed you the last 8 years.
Yeah,
excuse me, Madam Chair. We passed it the year before last, and then we came back and tweaked it last year. So 2 years ago we passed it.
Good. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Chair.
You bet. Mr. Grant, you got a phone call. Mr. Johnston and Mr. Jogish, please, if you could both come up, I'd appreciate it. Mr. Johnston is Director of Corporate Development Agency Relations and Officer of Legislative and Regulatory Reform for SMPA. And Mr. Jogish is Director of Energy Services for the Municipal Utilities Association. So welcome, and please state your name for the record.
I'm Robert Jogish. I'm the Director of Energy Services for Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. That's the 125 municipal electric utilities and the 35 municipal gas utilities spread throughout the state of Minnesota. I'm going to just basically discuss the smaller and the utilities that are more alone And Mr. Johnson's going to then cover the utilities that are associated with the joint action agencies, because there is a very large difference between them. The small utilities, the challenges for the small municipal utilities cannot be underestimated. We've got a lot of utilities out there where the only personnel they have is a billing clerk and three linemen. So managing a conservation improvement program for those type of utilities is a huge challenge. The utilities are in towns with populations of usually about 3,000 citizens or smaller. They also, though, provide unmatched service and reliability to their customers at very competitive electric rates. So they're doing an enormous job, but they just don't have the staffs. What we have done is gotten rather creative with these types of utilities, and I have an answer for Senator Metzen. He asked a question about how we're reaching out to our commercial and industrial customers. We have actually worked together with some of the other state entities to go out and meet with these people. We've started leaning on this clean energy resource teams at the University of Minnesota, using their personnel on the ground and their action, the people in the communities that are, you know, move and have action, to get a group together. We've then had the mayors come in on the programs, brought together what they thought the businesses would need. We brought in the Smart Energy Group from the State Chamber of Commerce to do the audits and start some of the processes with us. And if we find programs that they don't have that they need, then we've started to provide these small communities these programs. So these are some of the rather more exotic ways that we're having to deal with some of these things, but at the same time, when you're finding all these groups of people doing the same thing, why don't we just do them together? We've also done a couple of other continued partnerships with other multiple enterprises, organizations, businesses, and also the Office of Energy Security. We got together for the low-income programs with the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. And MNCAPs are now running some of the low-income programs for our smaller utilities. But we're also looking, along with the Office of OES, at ways to improve those low-income programs, make them more cost-effective, and get through some of the other issues associated with it, as Commissioner Grant spoke about, you know, the split incentive where there's just one meter on a large building filled with 40 apartments. And so we're working together to try to come to some solution on some of those issues. And as Senator Metzen asked, you know, what are we doing about government buildings? For the municipal utilities, those are number one. Those are the first we do, because if we're not walking the walk or talking the talk, then the citizens in our towns don't listen to us. So we're kind of working on that. One of the things is the current law does provide a greater incentive for utilities to create energy savings from measures affecting the amount of energy consumed by the customer than from the measures that could be taken to prevent energy waste from transmission, generation, and distribution. In other words, you can get more credit for doing the 1% on the customer side and then the 0.5% on the other side. For these smaller communities that don't have very many, of a small population, you can sometimes get a very large efficiency effort completed by going in and taking care of the supply side of their systems. And so that's something that I think we need to look at further as far as for the small utilities. We also have energy audits that are very difficult for a lot of our small utilities to do. So again, like I've said, we've partnered with the Energy Smart Group from the State Chamber of Commerce. We've actually even started working with the Schools for Energy and Water Conservation, which is part of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the University of Minnesota, where we're bringing them in, training students throughout towns to kind of be quasi-energy auditors and seeing what they come up with through their school. And then that kind of branches out. Then pretty soon you've got people at home doing these things, and you kind of get this growth opportunity there. Another thing that we've kind of looked at in the past and really would like to try is the Department of Energy funded a study at the Sacramento Municipal Utility District that was basically came out to strategic planting of shade trees, and that was for cooling, for air conditioning. So you could put these trees in. They have come up with these calculations of what you can come up with for energy savings based on the size of the tree, the type of the tree, everything. And the Department of Energy funded that study, and it's out on the street already. So that's another thing that we could possibly look at. We've also looked at for small electric utility, for electric utilities that are in areas where you have delivered fuels, which is propane or small natural gas utilities that aren't required to have conservation improvement programs. What we find is in these communities that they have towards, you know, the middle of the winter when you can't, they can't afford another tank of propane. So we've seen situations where the peak energy use in these towns has almost doubled because half the town has just started plugging in electric space heaters they got at Ace Hardware. And so we partnered with the Office of Energy Security to start looking into some of these situations. As part of a group with the Minnesota Environmental Initiative, we kind of came up with a small calculator that we're looking at, first to start on the low-income side, but I think we're going to have to branch out into, again, in these communities of 3,000 or smaller, into utilizing that more often also.
But Mr. Jagish, the energy dollars that are coming from the feds, I think, are have been proposed to be cut, so that's even going to be complicated.
Madam Chair, that is absolutely correct. Educational efforts are also, as Mr. Haas and Commissioner Grant talked about, is something that we need to still get our hands around. There is changes in behaviors and everything. To quantify those savings is still very difficult. We kind of made grounds this last year on getting to a starting point together, but we still have a ways to go. So we're still going to have to go after that type of structure. The one thing that our customers are demanding is that we don't stop offering these programs. These are integral now to being a utility. They expect us to do these things. They ask us to do these things. Sometimes we are slow at doing these things because it takes time for us to get moving and try to get the right people there. But it's still, we are constantly being asked about this.
And Mr. Jagish, are your customers falling in love with incandescent light bulbs? Because I'm telling you, I'm having a hard time with them. True confession.
Madam
Chair. Seriously, that is.
I'm hearing people of stockpiling 50 years worth. To answer a question from Senator Jungbauer and Senator Dibble about what the future technologies we're working on, we've partnered with the Office of Energy Security to look into doing some very small smart grid projects in some of our communities. In other words, we're going to go off and test this technology to see if it even works. It's much easier for us as small utilities to go after and test this out than anybody else can go do at a much cheaper cost. We've got most of the cities already penciled out. You know, the racer's been on the page a couple of times, but we're going forward with those kinds of programs to see what we can do. When you talk smart grid to a lot of people, you know, when people say we want some of that smart grid, usually my next question is, well, how many gallons do you want? Because nobody really knows what it is, and so it becomes this question of, is this technology going to actually be something that can be utilized? And we met with Best Buy, and so there's this constant talk out there, and so we're working together on that. And I think I'll just stop there for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jagish. Any questions? Okay. Mr. Johnston. Are you going to have enough time? And can you come back
Chair
on Tuesday?
Madam Chair.
Members of the committee, you've seen me do this kind of stuff in a couple minutes, okay? So what I'll attempt to do, I want you to work from this particular document, okay? And we'll see if we can pull that off. You'll get the abbreviated version. If you have more questions than we can handle today, I'd be available for you at any point in time.
Mr. Johnston, are you going to be back on Tuesday?
I can be if you would like.
I would like to have you back, too.
Okay.
Okay.
So kind of the Cliff Notes version of where we're headed with this. Let's leave page one behind because, really, you've seen a little bit of that when I've been here before that just says that municipal power agencies all have different contracts with their customers, and so we all do things slightly differently, but they're all engaged in working with their members and their customers in terms of the SIP program. The first slide, 3 of 11, if you will, on the top of the second page, just gives you a feel for who the SEMPA members are. But the real reason I wanted to have that on there is because while our members were doing things in the late 80s and the early 90s, when we first started doing our integrated resource planning program, we became aggressively involved in this process. And the thing I want to leave you with there is essentially that when we do our, you know, we see efficiency as a huge part of our supply mix. When we do our analysis, when we do our modeling internally, we end up with least cost plans that are lower cost if, in fact, we're able to achieve higher levels of DSM. So we believe very much in terms of that process. There's a website there you can take a look at. There's a give you a feel for the member programs that we have. And there is a quick summary sheet on the very back of this that gives you a feel for the programs. Over the next slide, it's just telling you that we've been aggressive enough that we've, thank goodness, been recognized very favorably a number of times by the Energy Star program, by DOE, by EPA, by the Wall Street Journal for the programs that we've tried to put in place. And we've come up with some very innovative approaches in different areas of trying to work commercial and industrial customers. Give you a little bit of information on that. Please flip to the next page, so slide 5 out of 11. Again, this is just to give you some sort of history on where we've been recently, kind of ties in with what you were hearing from Mr. Grant and Mr. Haas. But again, we believe in efficiency technologies. It does help us defer the need for additional resources. It assists us in developing least cost plans that have lower emissions for us. It provides our members and their customers with approaches for managing the cost of energy and improving productivity in many of the applications in industrial settings that we're in. And as a result, we've tried to very aggressively approach these programs. Now, what you're going to see in that little chart shows the SEMPA members' savings as a percent of retail sales over the period of time from 2006 through 2010. You'll see that those are pretty strong numbers regarding what we've been talking about here before. We tend not to step away from those programs even before the 1.5% came in effect in 2010 for a couple reasons. When you're working with industrial customers, they're competing. You heard Mr. Grant talk about this. They're competing for internal capital for projects all of the time. The last thing we want to do is be with a commercial industrial customer who is poised to make an efficiency investment and not be there to support them for that. That opportunity may never raise its head again. And so we pushed throughout the years for that. Officially, what we've kind of released so far for this year is that we're at 1.51%, but we're currently working with the department on one of the custom programs that they were talking about and getting the analysis done on that. We're estimating that we're probably going to be much closer to 1.7 for this particular year. So that having been said, we've seen some significant savings from these things. We've been aggressive. We've also been very lucky. We've looked at smart, cost-effective ways to try to get this information out to the customers. We can provide incentives, but at some point in time, the individual retail customer, even with their incentives and with their education, has to make a conscious decision to invest in the equipment. So that's always a limitation. That's always going to be there. We need to find quick ways around that. And we also need to rely on increasing technologies, as we've talked about earlier. So the question is really, how sustainable is this? At the time that we passed this law in 2007, the utilities all said we're going to work hard at this. You can see we've worked hard at it. We believe in it. It is the best thing that we can be doing in our utility. But that still doesn't mean that you're going to be able to hit those numbers forever on an indefinite process. Even the technical potential analysis that the state did for the state kind of completed last year, those folks said there will be difficulty in trying to get to those numbers on a sustainable basis. We agree with that. So the bottom line here is we begin to think about sustainability. We've really got two suggestions we'd like to talk about. One of them's kind of been hinted at. The other one really hasn't. We think that it's important when you go through this process looking at sustainability, you really take a good, hard look at what we're doing with the programs, what savings we're achieving, and what impact it really has. One of the things in that process is that we tend to count first-year savings. You heard Mr. Grant talk about that. So oftentimes we look to see if the technology we just invested in has a one-year useful life or it has a 20-year useful life. We would begin to suggest that we have a dialogue about that and begin to look at tracking and counting savings based on their useful life. The reason for that is you can kind of come up with some erroneous conclusions if you don't head in that direction, where you can look at this program that looks terribly, terribly cost-effective, but you haven't recognized that it's only terribly cost-effective for a short period of time. But you may have other programs that are a little bit more expensive, but over the time frame that you're getting the savings from, they can be quite cost effective. So we'd like to recommend a dialogue on that. Similar to what Mr. Jagish was talking about, again, the goal is that in the future we find ways to meet load much more efficiently by supplying less energy to meet that load. Okay, so regardless if it's coming from the supply side or the demand side or the customer side of the meter, we think those things really probably ought to count on an equal basis. The idea is to get the savings and to get the best savings, the most cost-effective savings on a go-forward basis. So that's a very, very quick synopsis. We work very closely with the department. The department's been great in terms of working with us, taking suggestions in terms of how to develop these programs, how to account for these programs, and we totally expect that that dialogue will continue. But so, again, we're very supportive of the effort. We do think we have some huge challenges, and we think we need to start there by having a good dialogue about how we count things and what we count.
He still
very
has
good, Mr. Johnston. You're very good.
Madam Chair, he still has 7 seconds left.
I know.
I can take that up if you'd like.
Madam Chair,
yes,
just read your title. That'll take about 3 minutes here. Holy cow. Did you look at that? It's...
Senator Metzen, that's been the story of my life. You're right.
Usually in the banking business, Madam Chair, you don't get a pay raise, you could just get a better title, and I think that's probably what's going on with you. You get 10 of them here.
But, Mr. Johnston, back to your suggestions that you are supportive of the program, but kind of just tell us more what you would like to – how you'd like to see this frame up so you can judge the sustainability on some of these new – technologies coming out. Hey,
Madam Chair,
you just left me with more questions, basically. So, yeah.
Sure. Members of the committee, we do think that I've liked very much the working groups, the MEI working group that has tried to work through some of these new issues. Lots of things have come about that the department's done, frankly, in the last couple of years that weren't in the original bill as a prescriptive element. For example, this whole behavioral activity. We're engaged in some of those. The department's worked very well with utilities to try to come and get at other sorts of technologies that we can get our hands on to get increased savings. I think that wide stakeholder sort of approach of all of the people involved in talking about what's really attainable and what's not attainable is critical for that. And I think it's very helpful when we start through that process, really talking about what types of activities, at what cost, and for what length of time of savings, which leads me to, you know, one of the primary things that we're interested in having a dialogue over.
Right.
Madam Chair.
That's excellent. Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I appreciate Mr. Johnson's comments and his ideas for, continuing this conversation. I think, some of Senator Metzen's earlier points on the generation side, on the supply side, there's tremendous potential. I think Mr. Grant's cool chart that showed the big arrows of input and output and the big loss, that's compelling. That's amazing. And if we could address some of that would be pretty exciting. If this is a way to count savings, the same savings twice, I'd be a little reluctant. Mm-hmm. But if it's a way to count effort over a greater period of time for some stuff that might have a return that's not as immediate as meets the eye initially, mm-hmm. I think that's a very powerful idea. Mm-hmm. I'm worried about an effort to count savings
absolutely
twice. Mm-hmm. It's like counting the same dollar twice. I think
right.
We need to be leery of that.
Right. But I think the discussion needs to be had. The reality is, we have to look forward.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I couldn't agree more. I'm not interested in counting anything twice. Frankly, to get to where we want to get to, we're going to need to be counting darn near everything once, okay? And almost everything. And that's kind of the point behind this. You know, historically, and I'm real happy to hear people's reaction to all this. Historically, when you started talking about dealing with things on the supply side sort of the business, one of the major concerns was that there was this thought process that all of those things were going to be what I might call free riders, because they would happen anyway, because that's the sort of a thing utility would do in the course of their business. Not necessarily true. Some of the things that we're talking about are pushing the envelope on the edge of efficiency on the supply side just as much as the things we're pushing on the customer side of the meter. And those investments aren't just willy-nilly made by utilities either, you know. So that dialogue that we can get together and look at what things really do and what we should really count is very meaningful.
Well, thank you, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Jagish. Really appreciate you coming. I hope you can come back for Tuesday, and hopefully we haven't quite figured out how we're going to make this work. I think it'll be a great dialogue we'll have again. The munis and co-ops utilities will be testifying, but thank you again. And any other further questions from the committee? Thank you for hanging in there. Nothing else. Meeting is adjourned.